This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. By the time champion cyclist Lance Armstrong confessed a career of doping to Oprah Winfrey in January, he'd already been stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles and banned from further competition. Our guests, Wall Street Journal reporters Reid Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell, covered and regularly broke stories about the investigation that ended Armstrong's career. Now they have a new book that chronicles Armstrong's emergence as a rich and powerful athlete and explores the remarkable breadth of the doping culture embraced by his pro cycling team. There were many co-conspirators, group blood transfusions on the team bus, and extensive efforts to silence and intimidate those who might expose the abuse. Albergati and O'Connell had several conversations with Armstrong in their reporting. Armstrong declined an invitation to appear on Fresh Air. Reid Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell's new book is called Wheelmen: Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Reid Albergati, Vanessa O'Connell, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to give us a little bit of a primer here. Explain how the team racing in an event like the Tour de France works. I mean, how a team, what formations it uses, what the roles of the different riders are as they compete.
Well, there are 9 riders on each team in the Tour de France, and these are trade teams. They're not national teams, so the riders can be from all over the world. In Lance Armstrong's case, they were the United States Postal Service team. And 8 of those 9 riders will all take turns, you know, essentially blocking the wind in order to make it as easy as possible for that 9th rider, that Lance Armstrong, to ultimately finish as high as possible in the overall standings in the race. Now, the Tour de France is 3 weeks long, so every bit of energy savings makes a huge difference over the course of those 3 weeks. So on the Postal Service team, the stronger Lance's 8 teammates were, the better off he was, because they could stay in the wind where, you know, they have to pedal 30% harder, you know, blocking the wind for Lance.
Right. And these supportive roles, there was a name for it, the domestiques, is that right?
Domestique, right. The name for those guys is domestique, which is kind of sounds sort of like a derisive term. But it's actually, to be a domestique in the Tour de France, it's like being a starter in the Super Bowl. You know, you might not be the quarterback, but you're playing a very important role. It means you're really one of the top 200 cyclists on the planet. So these domestiques were, you know, they had the ability to win races on their own. But in the Tour de France, you know, they were the linemen, essentially.
So in the early 90s, Lance Armstrong becomes a professional cyclist, is making a name for himself. Then in 1996, he is diagnosed with cancer. How serious was his prognosis?
Well, he waited a long time. He had some symptoms, but waited a long time to get checked out. And so the cancer had spread to his, you know, up his body, essentially, all the way to his brain. And it was very serious. I mean, at first it was, you know, a surgery, and then it turned out it was, you know, a lot of chemotherapy to try to get rid of it. It wasn't actually brain cancer, it was testicular cancer, but it had just spread.
There's been some speculation that Armstrong's doping, use of what, human growth hormone, might have sparked or contributed to his cancer. What are we to believe of that?
Well, the science on that is really, it's very contentious. I mean, some people feel that these drugs can contribute to cancer, but a lot of research shows that it probably doesn't. But what we've tried to do was get in the heads of some of the people, including Lance himself, and find out what they thought. And we found a guy named Jim Woodman, who was an early influence for Armstrong in the triathlon world. And Woodman was one of the few people with Armstrong shortly after he was recovering from cancer. And we had this anecdote where Woodman's actually in Lance's kitchen, and they're talking about performance-enhancing drugs in sports. And Lance essentially admits that he's done all manner of drugs. And Woodman asks him point blank, aren't you worried that that might have contributed to your cancer? And Lance said, well, not about the EPO, and that's the blood-boosting hormone that increases your red blood cell and oxygen going to your muscles. He said he wasn't worried about the EPO, but he was worried about human growth hormone, that might have done something to maybe advance the rate of the cancer spreading in his body.
When Armstrong got cancer, at that point, I mean, he was well along into his pro career and had a lot of business relationships, and he was used to being a public figure. How did he handle the cancer, you know, publicly among his friends and followers?
Well, he started a charity, the Lance Armstrong Foundation, which was originally geared toward curing testicular cancer and later became had a much broader goal, which was, you know, increasing funding, increasing awareness, really, of cancer.
And then in addition to that, his agent and his advisors realized that Armstrong's story was really much more powerful, especially in the United States, as a cancer survivor. So not only is he a cancer survivor, but he goes on to win the Tour de France in 1999. So he, of course, subsequently wrote an autobiography. He was selling movie rights to his life story. His agents and his advisors figured out that he was a much more compelling character, essentially, post-cancer, as a survivor who came back and went on to win the Tour de France.
We're speaking with Vanessa O'Connell and Reid Albergati. Their new book is called Wheelmen, Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. So after Lance Armstrong is declared cancer-free, you know, he goes to France and wins 7 straight Tour de France titles. And there's a moment that you describe it as first. In 1999, when he's won one of the stages of the race, where it's one of these high mountain climbs, and what a remarkable feat he put on. I want you to just talk about what he did there, and also a conversation that you report Greg LeMond, the cyclist, having with a mechanic who was watching Lance at the time.
Well, the stage you're describing is the climb up to the top of Sestriere, which was a really decisive stage in that year's race. And, you know, Lance had already won the prologue of the race. You know, he was looking like a favorite. But that on that stage, he really surprised everyone because he had never been much of a climber. He wasn't a pure climber. I mean, he could do it on one, you know, for a one-day race, maybe one stage during the tour. But here he was beating the best climbers, some of the best climbers in the world. And it was shocking to people. And that was the day that I think many people really remember Lance Armstrong coming into his own. And during that stage, it was a rainy day. He was sort of, you know, flying up the mountain and looked almost eerie. There weren't a ton of fans on the road, and he's got this sort of wet yellow jersey. I mean, it's a very vivid picture in my mind. But Greg LeMond was watching it on TV. And LeMond, you know, had won the tour 3 times. He had sort of at times been almost a mentor to Lance. He'd talked with him. He talked with Lance's mother about, you know, what it was like being a young professional cyclist. And he's sitting next to one of the mechanics for another team. LeMond hears this mechanic. The mechanic turns to LeMond and he says, you know, sur le juice, like he's on the juice. He's doping. And LeMond's like, what are you talking about? And this mechanic explains that everyone in the sport now is on EPO and a cocktail of drugs, and they just don't get tired anymore. And he points out how Lance is just flying up this mountain, and he doesn't even look like he's breathing hard. And LeMond kind of scratches his head and thinks, well, you know, I'm not sure if I believe this mechanic, and kind of forgets about it. But that was the moment when, you know, Greg LeMond's eyes really started opening to the doping problem in cycling. And throughout the book, you know, we kind of show how LeMond learned more and more about the doping on the U.S. Postal Team and became more and more disillusioned and eventually ended up talking about it publicly and becoming, you know, enemy number one for Lance and his minions.
Let's talk about how it actually worked. I mean, you say this wasn't somebody, you know, popping a needle in a men's room. This was a conspiracy that involved a lot of people. What were the drugs they were using? How were they ingesting or injecting them?
Well, it really evolved over time. I mean, early on, you know, when he won his first Tour de France, they were just taking EPO, which you couldn't test for at the time, so you could really use as much as you wanted. There was also testosterone patches and cortisone, and even an experimental drug called Actovegan, which was an extract of calf's blood, which was sort of crazy. But eventually there was a test for EPO. It was detectable in urine tests. So they had to find new ways to boost their red blood cell count, and what they settled on was blood transfusions. And that involved taking out about a half liter of blood, you know, months, weeks before the Tour de France, and then reinfusing that blood during the race. And essentially what they were doing was increasing the amount of blood in their body beyond what its normal capacity was. So they had more red blood cells, more oxygen going to their muscles. It was essentially the same thing as taking EPO, but it was their own blood, so it was very difficult to test for. And once they started doing that, it became much more complicated because you had all these people watching over you. You know, the French law enforcement were raiding hotel rooms during the tour. And to get away with doing two blood transfusions per rider per race, which is what they ultimately did, you know, it just involved transporting blood in motorcycles with refrigerated saddlebags and, you know, unmarked trailers and campers and multiple doctors. So it was a huge operation in the end.
To tell the story of the bus faking the breakdown.
Well, okay, so during the 2004 Tour de France, they were extremely worried about French law enforcement. So they had already done one reinfusion of blood on the first rest day during that race, or around the first rest day. They wanted to do another one. So none of the riders really knew exactly when this was going to take place. But one night, as their team bus was driving back to a hotel room, the bus pulls over on the side of the road. The bus driver gets out and puts up some cones as if the bus has broken down. But it hadn't broken down. Actually, they wanted to do a secret blood transfusion on the side of the road, and the broken down bus was the decoy. So that all the riders lie down on the floor of the bus, team doctors hang blood bags from the luggage racks and connect the end of those bags to the rider's veins.
And the blood bags are delivered by a guy on a motorcycle, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, that scene was first told by Floyd Landis in emails that we uncovered in 2010. And reading that, I mean, it was just one of the most shocking things that I've ever heard about professional sports. I mean, it's just incredible.
And you know, people wonder why the U.S. Postal Service would spend quite a lot of money on a bike team, on a, you know, a bike racing team that did most of what it did in Europe. How much did they spend on the postal team?
Over the course of many years, the Postal Service spent about $40 million, but it really started out with relatively small amounts, $1.5 million a year. What happened was the Postal Service renewed its contract as the team continued to win the Tour de France, and as Armstrong continued to dominate the sport, it renewed the contract and continually upped the amount it was spending. So over the course of several years, it was $40 million in total. And it wasn't just the U.S. Postal Service that was a sponsor of the team. The team lined up many other sponsors, from Trek to Nike to Giro helmets. And over the years, you know, these companies spent many, many millions of dollars to have their logos essentially on the team jerseys. And essentially the riders were like, you know, billboards on wheels.
The last half of the book is this really fascinating account of the unraveling of Armstrong's career and the exposure of his doping. But, you know, long before the investigations that really brought him down unfolded, there were plenty of stories. There were, you know, there were some tests were done of his blood samples from 1999, which revealed he'd had EPO. And there was a guy named David Walsh who was working on a book who were talking to people who had witnessed statements and activities about him. And there was a lawsuit by a company that felt it shouldn't have to pay a bonus owed him because he had been doping and therefore cheating to win some of his tour wins. And a lot of this was reported, but it didn't seem to have much impact. Why?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about the story is that there, like you said, I mean, there really was a scandal every single year. And because of his position as this crusader against cancer, he was larger than life, and people did not want to believe that he could cheat in bike racing. And so they really just, and this includes mainstream media, really just ignored all of this evidence that showed that he was doping. And he was so charismatic and able to lie, really, to the face of so many people, including all of his followers, and convince them that all these allegations were just completely false.
And also, I would say, in hindsight, Armstrong had two very powerful arguments that really held sway with the public. One was, hey, I survived cancer. Why would I take drugs? Why would I do that to myself? That was an argument that I think really, really resonated with the public, even though it was a lie. The other is, I've been tested hundreds of times, and I've never had a positive drug test. And people really also bought into that. They didn't really fully understand that it was easy for the cyclists to beat these tests, to get around them, and that drug testing at that time was meaningless. So, you know, Armstrong had some very, very powerful messages, and people really bought into it.
So if you're Lance Armstrong and you're seeing all of this happening, and there's a criminal investigation, then eventually an equally serious investigation by the anti-doping agency, how did he respond?
I mean, during the criminal investigation, Lance was completely terrified. I mean, the guy was, it wasn't just he might lose his titles. This was, he could go to prison. And I think he told one person, actually, and we found out about it, that, you know, he would be happy if they just took his titles as long as he didn't go to prison. So, and this was whole new territory for him. This wasn't just, you know, trying to save his reputation. This was saving, you know, keeping his freedom. The federal investigation was dropped in February of 2012. And at that point, I think he was really breathing a sigh of relief. And he started to compete in triathlons, sort of move on, you know, with his life. And before he could really even do that, this USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency investigation began. And riders who had testified in front of the grand jury or just talking with federal investigators started to go in and tell their stories to USADA. And that's when USADA really, their case started moving forward. And, you know, pretty soon Armstrong realized that he had a whole new headache on his hands. And, you know, it was amazing how quickly everything happened. I mean, in the 6 months, the second half of 2012, you know, he went from being an athlete, you know, really on the top of the world, making a comeback in triathlon, to losing all of his sponsors, all of his income, all of his Tour de France titles. I mean, it just happened so fast, and I think that hit him like a ton of bricks. He was completely shocked by that.
There was a point when Armstrong, you know, facing the condemnation of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, thought he might appeal to them personally and strike a deal to allow him to continue competing. Tell us about that meeting.
Well, so Lance went into this meeting in Denver last year saying, you know, look, I'll come clean. I'll tell the truth, and I'll talk about lots of other people and their role in this whole conspiracy, but I want to get back to competing in triathlons within a year or less. And USADA's response to that was, look, there's nothing in the rules that allows us to let you get back to competing at that point. I mean, we can reduce this from a lifetime ban to, say, a ban of 8 years, but that's about as much as we can do. And Lance, he rejected that. He said, I'm not going to talk to you then, and we know what happened next. He went to Oprah.
Yeah, I wanted to. So how did he do with Oprah?
I mean, I think all the critics would say he did horribly. I mean, his attempt was to salvage his image, but he came across as a guy who was not really sorry for what he had done. And, you know, he cracked some sort of crude jokes and, you know, just a lot of people you heard describing him as a sociopath after that interview.
Couple of things. You write that his sponsors stuck with him through thick and thin. What moral responsibility do they have in protecting Lance? And I mean, are they complicit in maintaining a doping culture?
Without getting into the morality question, I mean, I think the lesson here is that, you know, you can't if you sit around and you ignore and you're willfully blind to all of those allegations over the years that we talked about, you know, one day the truth is going to come out, and all these people, you know, around him, they now look bad because they did ignore it over the years. So, you know, his sponsors and business managers and all these people close to him, I mean, they all sort of have egg on their face.
And not only that, but I mean, essentially, the sponsors were endorsing him. These were endorsements, and they continued to endorse him. In the public's eye, that really meant a lot. I mean, the fact that Nike stood by Lance Armstrong, despite all of those allegations, really almost up into the very end, meant a lot in the public eye. And it wasn't until Nike really dropped him towards the end of 2012 that a lot of people were like, whoa, now let's pay attention.
So Lance Armstrong now has had all of his titles stripped. He's banned from competition. He's lost these sponsors. But that's not all. He faces some other legal problems, doesn't he?
So Floyd Landis sued him in 2010 under the Federal False Claims Act, in which a U.S. citizen can sue anyone on behalf of the government for fraud against the government. So because his sponsor, because Lance's sponsor was the United States Postal Service, and the contract with the USPS said you couldn't dope, it's therefore, you know, fraud against the government, or at least that's the allegation. And last year, the U.S. Department of Justice actually joined Landis's suit. So, and because if you lose a Federal False Claims Act lawsuit, you could be responsible for up to triple damages. We're talking about $120 million, or three times the $40 million that USPS paid over the years.
Wow.
And that's partly why we've always seen this story as, you know, not just a story about a doping in sport or cheating in sport, but rather a story about cheating a business enterprise, essentially, and even a very interesting kind of legal truth and justice type story. The fact that this lawsuit is going to play out this fall means that there are still sort of a lot of, you know, moving parts. We have yet to see what's going to happen with the lawsuit that's seeking $120 million from Lance Armstrong and a couple of his close associates.
You know, Lance Armstrong's fall is one of the most remarkable stories in American sports. I mean, you know, from where he was to where he is now is just stunning. He's only 42. What do you think the rest of his life might be like?
I think a lot of it depends on the outcome of the whistleblower lawsuit. I mean, if he loses a significant chunk of his net worth, then he's going to have to find some way to make income, and he can't compete, at least not now. So I think there are just so many questions.
And although we can't pretend to know what Armstrong will do, I think that it's likely that he will try to come out with his own narrative, his own account, if he can, when the time is right. I don't think that that time will be anytime particularly soon, but I'm sure he feels that he has a story to tell and he would like to get his side fully out. So we can anticipate he'll make an attempt to do that, and certainly he'll make an attempt to rehabilitate his image when he feels the coast is clear and the time is right. How far that will go or how successful that will be will really depend on how he does that and whether people believe that he is truly remorseful.
Vanessa O'Connell and Reid Albergati are the authors of the new book, Wheelmen: Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies on our website, freshair.npr.org. In the iconic novels written by Helen Fielding, wine-guzzling heroine Bridget Jones was always ready for a good time. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says a wise girl should know when to leave the party. Maureen has reviews of the latest Bridget Jones sequel, as well as a new collection of writing from the feminist website Jezebel.
Dizzy dames don't age well. An attractive young thing doing pratfalls is disarming. An older woman stumbling around for laughs spells hip replacement. Sad to say, Bridget Jones has hung on to her once endearing daffiness, self-deprecation, and wine dependency far past their collective expiration date. That's one of the big reasons why her latest outing, called Mad About the Boy, is painful to read. Speaking as an original Bridget fan, I would have hoped that by 51, the age she is here, Bridget would have become more grounded. She needn't love her loosening skin, but by now she should be more at home in it. I think, of course, of Nora Ephron, who so famously felt bad about her neck, but was also sharp about the cultural pressures that made her feel like she should always cover it up with a scarf. This older incarnation of Bridget, however, is still swamped by unattractive insecurities. As ever, she records every pound gained or lost in order to squeeze herself into stretch jeans and thigh-high boots and go out trolling for love. Helen Fielding's first Bridget Jones novel, which debuted in 1996, as well as the 2001 movie made from it, were fun riffs on Pride and Prejudice, with Bridget in the role of beloved heroine Elizabeth Bennet. Mad About the Boy, however, unintentionally calls to mind another British literary classic, Great Expectations, with Bridget as a grotesque Miss Havisham, eternally aping the frozen in amber giddiness of her youth. The premise of Mad About the Boy is that Bridget's dishy husband, Mark Darcy, has died 4 years earlier while on a human rights mission. Bridget, a self-described geriatric mum of two small children, now finds herself vaguely yearning to shed her celibacy and plunge into the dating game again. I'll admit that there are isolated passages in this third Bridget Jones book that made me laugh as of old. When, for instance, Bridget decides to get a Twitter account and 75 followers magically appear, she resolves to show leadership by sending out a welcome tweet. It reads, "Welcome, followers, I am thy leader. Ye art most welcome to my cult." Dopey, sure, but preferable to, say, the humiliating scene where an eternally awkward Bridget is stuck dangling from a tree in her thong underwear. The earlier novels also had scenes like that. Bridget often lost clothing and awaited rescue by the buttoned-up Mr. Darcy. The feminism of the Bridget Jones books certainly didn't derive from their traditional romantic plots or any conscious resistance on Bridget's part. Instead, it was the humor of those novels that made them mildly anarchic. Bridget's goofy failures in fitting into the prescribed female roles subverted them. This third book is depressing precisely because Bridget is still trying to fit in at an age when she should know better. The joke is all on Bridget here. If you're looking for jolly feminist cultural commentary, give Mad About the Boy a pass and instead pick up the Book of Jezebel. This is a lavish encyclopedia composed of contributions from the writers and artists who've helped shape the Jezebel website, which was created in 2007 by award-winning writer Anna Holmes. The Book of Jezebel is packed with gorgeous graphics and photos, as well as witty and unruly entries on everything from Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie books to speculums. Most gloriously, this is an encyclopedia with a voice. Take, for instance, the entry on conservative commentator Ann Coulter, which notes that she subsists on a diet of kittens. There's even a prophetic entry for Bridget Jones's diary, which observes that the enormous popularity of the first novel inspired the mostly crappy chick lit craze, which eventually cannibalized the genre's original heroine. They got that right without even seeing this most recent Bridget Jones sequel. Rest in peace, Bridget Jones. Live long and prosper, Jezebel.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bridget Jones' Mad About the Boy and The Book of Jezebel, an illustrated encyclopedia of lady things. The new movie 12 Years a Slave was described by David Denby in The New Yorker as easily the greatest feature film ever made about American slavery. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with the star of 12 Years a Slave, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and the film's director, Steve McQueen. 12 Years a Slave is adapted from the 1853 memoir by Solomon Northup. Northup had been a free black man in upstate New York. A husband and father, he was a literate working man who also made money as a fiddler. But in 1841, after being lured to Washington, D.C. with the promise of several days' work as a fiddler with the circus, he was kidnapped into slavery. Let's start with a clip from 12 Years a Slave. In this scene, Solomon Northup has just been kidnapped and sold to slave traders and is on a ship heading towards Louisiana. He's talking to other slaves on the ship.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Steve McQueen, Chiwetel Ejiofor, welcome to Fresh Air. Steve McQueen, let me start with you. Why did you want to make a film adaptation of a memoir by a free man from the North who was kidnapped into slavery? Why did you choose that book?
Well, what happened originally is I had an idea of having a free man from the North, because I was just thinking about ideas and how I can have an in into the narrative. A free man from the North who gets kidnapped and pulled into the maze of slavery. And I like the idea that the audience follows this person in every step that he takes within the context of slavery, just to illuminate what that world was. And I was having a bit of difficulty. I was working with John Rilley on the script. We were having a little bit of difficulty. And my wife said to me, well, why don't you look into first-hand accounts of slavery? I thought, oh, yeah, of course. And she did some research. And I did some research, but she found this book called 12 Years a Slave. And I read this book, and I was totally stunned. It was like something sort of a bolt coming out of the sky. And at the same time, I was pretty upset with myself that I didn't know this book. How come I did not know this book? And slowly but surely, I realized that most people, in fact, all the people I knew, did not know this book. And, you know, I live in Amsterdam, where Anne Frank is a national hero. She's not just a national hero, she's a world hero. And for me, this book read like Anne Frank's diary, but written 97 years before, a first-hand account of slavery. And I basically made it my passion to make this book into a film.
Steve McQueen, I know one of your parents is from Grenada and one from Trinidad, so they're both from islands in the Caribbean. Were their ancestors slaves, do you know?
Yes, of course, yes, they were slaves. My trajectory as such of being introduced to slavery was fairly immediate because my parents were from the West Indies. And, you know, at school there was reference to slavery, but not much. So it's one of those things which I found out through my parents and obviously traveling back to the West Indies. The only difference I would say that anything between myself and African-American is their boat went right and my boat went left.
I think of 12 Years a Slave as a very experiential film, and it's much more about Solomon Northup's experience as a slave than it is about, like, the larger historical context of slavery. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, what that meant for you is that you're going to be doing a lot of suffering on camera. mean, you know, like, it's your body is put through so much. And I'm, you know, just like one example is early in the film when after you're kidnapped, you are beaten with a plank of wood and beaten so hard that the wood breaks. There's whippings and you're hanging. And were you uncomfortable about the idea of taking on a role in which you knew you'd have to endure so much suffering? Because I'm sure, even though obviously you weren't really physically injured in the way that your character is, you emotionally had to experience that to the extent that you're capable of as an actor.
Yeah, the you know, those aspects of the film, you know, I suppose in a way, they're very necessary to kind of understand Solomon's psychological journey. You know, to understand who he is, what he's endured, and actually, in a wider sense, what people endured in that time. And I think that it gave audiences and gives audiences a chance to really understand the inner workings of what's happening. And so it sort of, you know, I think if you're playing somebody, if you're playing a real person, you're always seeking to, in a way, legitimize your relationship with that person, you know, to have the right to tell their story. And I felt that sometimes when we were doing things that Solomon describes in the book that he went through, and we were recreating these moments as accurately as we could, and that would mean me being uncomfortable. What it meant was it sort of legitimized our relationship, and it made it easier for me to walk with him and to tell his story.
There's a scene I want to ask you about that's a real kind of emotional turning point for Solomon Northup in the film. He is forced to whip a young woman who he's very fond of. And he knows that if he doesn't whip her, that the slave master will do it. So, like, he figures, you know, he'll whip her lightly. But he can't get away with that. The slave owner demands a harsher whipping. And I think that would be a very telling point in the emotional life of Solomon Northup. And I was wondering if you could each talk about what that scene meant to you, that he was put in the position of knowing that things would be even worse if he didn't whip her himself.
Well, I think, you know, it's this is what we're talking about. I mean, this is why people were kept in captivity for 400 years, because of those kind of events. This is a true event. So what happened at that scene is that Epps, the slave master you're talking about, says to him, if he doesn't do it, he will kill everyone here. What choice does he have? I mean, these are kind of choices that have been made, unfortunately, throughout history, throughout the most horrendous moments in history, that people do in order to survive.
It's almost, you know, the thing is that it's not necessarily what Epps, the plantation owner, is going for. He's not necessarily doing this in order to hurt Solomon psychologically. He is going through his own crisis in the sense that he is in love with this girl, with Patsy, his slave girl, and he is in such kind of conflict and anger and self-hatred about that in the moment, even though he wants to whip her, he can't, and he's unable to do it. Which is why he sort of almost casually turns to Solomon and orders him to. And then what that does, of course, with Solomon is this: it's the physical and the psychological, and that is, I think, what is always in balance and always in play in these places, in these scenes, and in the book, and in the way that Solomon describes what is happening, is that there's the physical aspect of it, but there's also the psychological. And in a way, I think that Solomon was able to, at that point, had found ways of protecting himself from Master Epps, of protecting himself physically, from protecting himself emotionally, from protecting himself psychologically. But this was something else. This was something he did not envisage, that he would have to be forced to participate in injuring somebody that he cared so deeply about. So it's in a sense, it just speaks to all the levels of captivity and the three-dimensional nature of what was going on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve McQueen, the director of the new film 12 Years a Slave, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is the star of the film. He plays Solomon Northup, a free man from the North who's kidnapped into slavery in the South and is forced to be a slave for 12 years until he manages to get out. Steve McQueen, you might really disagree with me on this, but having seen all three of your movies, Hunger, about Bobby Sands, who's played by Michael Fassbender. I mean, Michael Fassbender is absolutely skeletal by the time the movie ends. And then Michael Fassbender stars again in Shame, in which he's I guess you'd call him a sex addict, but I it's hard to say if he gets any pleasure out of sex. I mean, it's a compulsion that he has to follow.
Well, after a while, most addicts don't get pleasure.
Yes,
exactly.
What
they do.
Exactly.
Becomes necessity.
Exactly. And now 12 Years a Slave, in which there's, you know, again, very physical suffering. And so I can't help but think there's something that interests you about psychic and physical suffering, and that your movies are all about the body in some way, you know, the hunger strike, the sexual compulsion, the physical endurance of somebody who is a slave, but their body and spirit manages to survive.
No, listen, I'm interested in, you know, the hunger strike. It was the biggest thing politically that happened in Britain in the past 27 years. 10 men dying of hunger in a British prison cell. It was deafening, but no one was speaking about it. That's why I made the picture. As far as shame is concerned, this phenomenon about sex addiction, and I wanted to investigate that because it's something that everyone has a relationship with, sex. And it was, again, it was this elephant in the room. And that's what I wanted to make the picture about, because it was about this this addiction, which has been sort of, how can I say, has been thriving also due to the internet. And slavery, well, I mean, I don't know how obvious you could be. I mean, all you got to do is walk down the street and you see the evidence of slavery in everyday life. But there's a huge silence about it. It's a deafening silence about it. You know, why are prison population of black males so huge? Why is poverty in black communities so huge? Why is mental health? Why is education so poor? Why? And when you ask yourself that question, it all leads down to what happened in slavery, because no one has, once it has stopped, everyone was left to get on with their own devices, but without a platform, without a leg up. And there you have the evidence of slavery. So these are huge events, deafening events, which I feel needed a platform. And the only platform for me as an artist was cinema, because for me it's the greatest art form there is. The question is, why hasn't there been a film like this on slavery?
One of the things that you do in some of your movies, and certainly in 12 Years a Slave, is have scenes last a little longer than we'd expect. And because things are edited so quickly now. I mean, like, there's a lot of movies that are scenes last for such a short period of time, and the same goes for a lot of TV shows, particularly comedy series now. And there are a few scenes, without mentioning them by name, in which something terrible is being endured, and just as we think, like, oh, the scene's going to end, it doesn't. And you keep our eye on that scene longer than we expected, and longer than is comfortable, which I think is very intentional on your part, because you want it to be more uncomfortable than just, it's another movie scene.
But also to be present, I think it's not just, yes, those are the sort of fundamentals of it, but what it's to do is to do with being present as a viewer, to being there, to shoot things in real time rather than movie time. So, for example, the sequence where Patsy's getting whipped that we spoke about before, that shot, I think, is 10 minutes. To be present in that is to sort of lose the frame and to hold the tension and to not, to be there in a kind of reality. That's what I want. That was the chosen effect that I wanted. And it works, for me, it works in a way because it doesn't allow the viewer off the hook.
In shooting the movie, Steve McQueen, you have an incredible eye in making films, and I'm wondering if you referred to daguerreotype photographs or old paintings or any other historical artifacts to...
It was the state of Louisiana. It was New Orleans. It was those plantations. It was that sort of... myself and Sean Byman, my cameraman, who I'm working with for 13 years, it was just the environment, the landscape that sort of was so rich, that it just lent to so many ideas and images. We went in there naked and came out there fully clothed. It was just amazing how, you just look at things and you find things in that environment. It was so rich. And of course, like I said, before, the most beautiful, horrible things happen in the most beautiful places. It was just so rich. And the sound of the cicadas, they almost act like a choir at certain points. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Did you see, besides being on former plantations in Louisiana where you shot, did you see any other artifacts of slavery that survive?
Yes, we saw the actual slave shacks. There were a lot of slave shacks which are still there, which they were vacated. I mean, what happened was that after the slave shacks were built, they were there. So what happened was, I think people actually lived in them for a while, and I think that they were like vacated during the sort of late 70s. I think lots of people living in them since the late 70s, but they were there, and you had these shotgun houses there still there too. It was pretty incredible. It's a shame, but they're not being looked after very well. Of course, they're being left to sort of the elements, but there you have it.
And getting back to the idea that you want us to experience what slavery was like, and I think that happens. And it's difficult to endure. It's a very painful film to watch because you are putting yourself as a viewer in the shoes of Solomon Northup. And what makes it especially easy, I think, for everybody to do that is he starts as a free man. And you know, like, well, you're a free person. He was a free person. And imagine what it would be like to suddenly be a slave. I mean, it's just so easy to identify whether you are descendant from a slave or not. But there's so much suffering that you endure secondhand in watching the movie. And I guess I'm wondering, where is the line for you between, like, how much you want to put your audience through and how much is just going to be like a little too much for a film? Is that the kind of thing you think about when setting out to make a film like this?
Well, yeah, I think if you read the book, it's a lot. It's too much. And actually, there are 5 acts of violence in the whole film. 5. In 2 hours and 11 minutes. But it's to do with the context. And that's the issue, because I think people don't want to think of the past. They would rather be blind than to sort of look at what the evidence of things which are around them. People don't want that responsibility. They would rather look at a horror movie or a thriller and people get shot in the head every 15 minutes. But, you know, I feel that, you know, it's like looking at Schindler's List or looking at The Pianist or looking at whatever Holocaust film there is. That's our responsibility as humans to sort of reflect on our recent past in order to find out where we are and where we're going.
Steve McQueen directed the new film 12 Years a Slave. Chiwetel Ejiofor stars in it. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer this week is Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.